Good evening, everyone. Good evening, everyone. Hello, and it's nice to see everyone here today. Welcome to the third annual lecture presented by the AHRC Research Center for Law, Gender, and Sexuality. My name is Allison Diddick, and I'm one of the co-chairs of the advisory board of the center. My co, Daniel Monk, is here tonight as well. As I'm sure you know, since its inception in 2004, the center's been at the forefront of work that investigates and analyzes the relationship between law, gender, and sexuality. Through the combination of the work of the individual researchers from the partner universities of the center, Keele University, University of Kent at Canterbury, and here at the University of Westminster, and work organized by the center itself, we've all had the opportunity to participate in national and international conferences and workshops of a wonderfully interdisciplinary and exciting nature. We've seen in the past year, for example, a major conference on human rights, workshops in cultural studies, intimacies and relationships, international development, and health. Exciting forthcoming events include a lecture by Professor Rosalind Petesky, a workshop at Keele University in June on reproduction, and a major international conference in July, the 9th to the 11th of July, entitled Gender Unbound. This will be at Keele University and promises to be a truly exciting event. Eminent plenary speakers span a range of disciplines. We'll hear and see and get to meet Hazel Carby, Sandra Gilman, Rosemary Hennessy, and Carol Smart. Further details about this conference and other forthcoming projects at the center are available on the center website. Today, however, we're privileged to have with us to present this annual lecture a distinguished political theorist, Lois McNay, reader in politics from the Oxford University. Lois's influential work on Foucault and feminism has become virtually required reading for those of us who are interested in feminism and social theory. Her more recent work, Gender and Agency, published in 2000, is concerned with theories of the subject, agency, gender, gender identity. It's an exceptionally enlightening configuration of the work of leading feminist theorists and continental social theorists. Lois's most recent book, Against Recognition, will be out in September of this year. And Lois was generous enough this morning to spend some time with postgraduate students here at the University of Westminster on a question and answer session about some of the issues that she's written about in that forthcoming book. And I'm sure we'll all be keeping our eyes open, the bookshops and the Polity website in September.
We've got some flyers.
And we have some flyers for that book. In the meantime, though, while we await publication of that book, I'm delighted to introduce Lois today. The title of her lecture today is The Trouble with Recognition. As Rosemary said earlier, Lois will be happy to take questions and observations and have a chat about what she says here today informally at a reception following this lecture. So for now, I'm very, very pleased and honored to introduce to you Lois McNay.
In the last decade or so, the idea of the struggle for recognition has become a dominant way of representing the increasingly central role played by identity claims in social and political conflict. The catalyst for this resurgence of interest in recognition is the signal essay by Charles Taylor on the politics of recognition, although the original formulation of the struggle for recognition can be traced back, of course, to the famous passage on lordship and bondage in Hegel's Phenomenology of Spirit. One of the particular advantages of using the trope of recognition to represent social and political conflict is that it draws attention to aspects of identity that are underplayed in conventional liberal thought. In particular, it provides an alternative basis for normative theory beyond the individualistic or monadic conceptions of the subject, what Habermas has called the philosophy of the subject, that dominate conventional social and political thought. The recognition perspective replaces a monological conception of the subject with a dialogical conception, where individuals are understood not as atomized pre-social beings, but as beings who only know themselves through interaction with others. The claim that subjectivity is dialogical in nature allows social and political theory to be recast around the insight of the central importance of intersubjective relations rather than instrumental or strategic ones to social life. It also draws attention to the situated nature of the individual, that is, to think meaningfully about desirable social arrangements, individuals must be understood as ineluctably embedded within a given social or cultural context. To conceptualise individuals as abstract pre-social subjects, as certain types of liberal Anglo-American philosophy tend to do, is to almost certainly disregard the specific mechanisms by which hierarchical differences of race, gender, and culture are perpetuated. It is because of this emphasis on the dialogical and situated nature of subjectivity that the idea of recognition has been taken up and elaborated by a multiplicity of thinkers interested in communitarian politics, multiculturalism, and theories of deliberative democracy. Feminists have also found the idea of recognition attractive, partly because it resonates with their attempts to conceptualise subjectivity and agency beyond the well-known analytical limitations of the disembodied and disembedded subject of conventional masculinist thought. Furthermore, the implicit normative content of the idea of recognition, which could be loosely expressed as an ideal of self-realisation through the acknowledgement and acceptance of the differences of the other, has been used by feminist thinkers such as Shula Ben-Habib and Jessica Benjamin as an antidote to what are seen as the ethical shortcomings of the neo-Nietzschean tendencies of post-structural thought. In different ways, both thinkers draw out the emancipatory potential of a dialogical concept of identity, showing how an emphasis on difference need not lead to normative relativism or a fragmented politics of the self, but is compatible with communicatively conceived democratic structures. As fruitful as this dialogical conception of identity proposed by thinkers of recognition has been, it has inevitably attracted much criticism. From the perspective of thinkers informed by the more rigorous constructivism of Marxist and post-structural thought, the central difficulty is that many thinkers of recognition construe identity and subjectivity in an essentialist manner. This claim has perhaps been most influentially formulated by Nancy Fraser, who argues that what she terms the free-floating idea of recognition reifies identity by abstracting it from its social and political context, and also leads to a reductive, over-psychological account of political conflict. Thinkers such as Charles Taylor and Axel Honneth tend to regard recognition as an innate and natural desire on the part of individuals and groups, and one which can be satisfied only through the free expression and full public acknowledgement of some kind of authentic identity. This idea that individuals and groups have spontaneous integral identities which will unfurl themselves once certain social constraints have been removed is, of course, from a constructive perspective, problematic on many counts. These are too numerous to list here, but ultimately, most of these theoretical difficulties can be traced to an underlying tendency on the part of recognition thinkers to naturalise the process of identity formation by disconnecting it from an account of power. This is as true, in my view, of thinkers such as Habermas, Ben-Habib and Benjamin, who are supposedly more attuned to the effects of power on the subjects, as it is the case for the more liberal thinkers of recognition, such as Taylor. This naturalisation means that thinkers of recognition often significantly underplay the fragilities, contingencies, and tensions inherent in the struggles through which individual and group identities are established and related political claims made. The paradox is then that although thinkers of recognition insist on the situated nature of identity, i.e., that it is exhaustively constituted by its social context, They undermine this insight by imputing to subjects and identities certain pre-social essential features. Recently, several influential thinkers have come to focus on the idea of suffering as a key symptom of the problematic naturalising tendencies of the recognition approach to identity. For thinkers of recognition, the suffering that arises from the lack of social esteem accorded to individuals and groups forms the motivational impetus and the moral centre of recognition struggles. So, as Axel Honneth puts it, quote, "Social suffering and discontent possess a normative core. Such feelings of discontent and suffering coincide with the experience that society is doing something unjust, something unjustifiable." It follows, however, from the essentialist concept of identity used by thinkers like Honneth, that the idea of suffering also tends to be reified by attaching to it some self-evident moral legitimacy, in the sense that it is regarded as some kind of incontestable evidence of oppression and injustice. What many critics object to in this emotivist approach to social conflict is that suffering itself is no necessary guarantor of social injustice. There are many types of injustice that are not accompanied by psychic distress or damaged self-esteem, for example, some of the systemically generated inequalities of labour markets. Conversely, there are suffering claims made by certain groups that we might consider invalid or spurious or less worthy of attention than other claims. By making the suffering of personal injury the sine qua non of social injustice, thinkers of recognition forego more rigorous criteria with which they might be able to distinguish between competing claims, some of which are more legitimate than others. In other words, suffering should not always be taken as a spontaneous, authentic response to injustice, but rather must be considered, along with other desires and emotions, as a certain type of discourse that is as constructed and contingent and open to ideological deconstruction as any other. And several prominent thinkers have called into question the legitimacy that is attributed to a rhetoric of suffering in the politics of recognition, where, in Laurent Ballant's words, trauma stands as truth. Focusing on the US, Ballant argues, for example, that contemporary social and political life is saturated by a certain manufactured discourse of suffering, which is itself a symptom of a wider neoliberal depoliticisation of citizenship. From the Reagan period onwards, US citizenship has been reconfigured in the language of a privatised individualism in order to diffuse the critical and socially destabilising energies that were originally unleashed by the civil movements and unrest of the 1960s. A key strategy in this privatisation of citizenship has been the dissemination of an insidious rhetoric of intimacy and, in particular, of personal suffering. A vicious yet sentimental, those are her terms, discourse of individual suffering has become the absolute precondition of making any kind of political claim. And one of its pervasive consequences is to deflect attention away from the suffering that arises from genuine oppression. As Ballant puts it, the public rhetoric of citizen trauma has become so pervasive and competitive in the United States that it obscures basic differences among modes of identity, hierarchy, and violence. Mass national pain threatens to turn into banality. In a more psychoanalytic register, Wendy Brown has considered some of the negative political implications of individuals and groups becoming attached to their own subjugation and suffering. Using a mixture of Freud and Nietzsche, Brown unpicks the masochistic dynamics of subaltern identities that are fetishistically constructed around the idea of suffering, in particular around the compulsion to repeat and relive the primal injury of oppression or exclusion. The symbolic and actual violence that gives rise to politicised gender and racial identity is constantly reiterated, both through repeated acts of racism and sexism, and also through the subject's own compulsion to re-experience that punishment. This restaging of the original trauma yields an erotic gratification and is also generative of psychic and political reassurances. One of these reassurances is that, in an era of declining community, it creates an imaginary bond with others who share in the suffering. At the same time, however, this psychic investment in reliving the primal injury affects a kind of political paralysis of the subject. The subject remains enthralled to a compulsive oscillation between desiring to be punished through the replaying of their injuries and aggressively desiring the punishment of others for this humiliation. While, as Brown puts it, freedom as a wish or a practice is nowhere to be found. More bluntly, Beverly Skeggs has argued that political claims made through the discourse of suffering are forms of middle-class self-display, from which the working classes are profoundly alienated. Calling attention to one's pain is essentially, in her view, the most recent expression of a type of bourgeois personhood, and is an ostentation that working class individuals are temperamentally inclined to avoid. As she puts it, only some groups can articulate their identities through wound or pain, and only some groups would want to. Only some groups can produce their subjectivity in this way and focus on themselves and their experience as a basis for knowledge. In sum, there seems to be an emerging consensus amongst some theorists that adherence to a politics of injury and suffering prevents the exploration of more positive and emancipatory forms of agency and being. This uncritical phenomenology of suffering, what Wendy Brown and Janet Halley referred to in the introduction of Left Legalism, Left Critique as suffer-mongering, is an expression of a more prevalent subjectivism in thought on recognition, which treats individual experience as inherently authentic and incontestable. In order to combat this subjectivism, there is a tendency amongst critics of recognition to move away, therefore, from any kind of interpretive focus on the experiential dimensions of identity and subjectivity, and towards what I've called an objectivist account of identity as a social construct. This move towards objectivism, where identity is understood not as a lived reality so much as a discursive construction, is, in my view, not confined to those critical of the idea of recognition, but is a widespread tendency in contemporary thought on identity, which has its roots in the linguistic turn ushered in by structural and post-structural thought. There is no doubt that this approach to identity as a discursive construct yields very important insights. But the consequent abandonment of any interpretive account of the experiential or lived dimensions of identity weakens this objectivist thought in certain crucial ways, especially with regard to explaining some aspects of agency. I want to illustrate some of the difficulties with this move to objectivism by looking briefly at the dispute over the idea of suffering, which forms a small part of the much more wide-ranging debate between Axel Honneth and Nancy Fraser on recognition and redistribution. The core of the debate, to put it very schematically, revolves around the disagreement between Honneth and Fraser about how to characterise the nature of contemporary political conflict. In his book, The Struggle for Recognition, Honneth argues that all social and political conflicts, including economic disputes over distribution, can be characterised as recognition struggles that are catalysed at some level by individuals' deep-rooted need for free and publicly esteemed self-expression. Against this, Fraser argues that Honneth is simply wrong to typify all social and political conflict as flowing from an ontogenetic need for recognition. There are many types of conflict, distributive ones especially, that have nothing to do with personal injury, and to construe them in such a manner is to fall into a psychological reductionism. She makes two proposals to counter the overextension of the recognition model of conflict. The first is her well-known perspectival dualism of recognition and redistribution, about which much has been written and about which I don't intend to speak. Her second proposal, well, she actually makes three, doesn't she, about representation, but I'm not talking about that. Her second proposal is that to avoid the subjectivism of the free-floating idea of recognition, where injustice is construed as psychic injury, she claims that recognition and misrecognition must be reconstructed in a more objective and what she calls non-identarian fashion. In other words, the idea of a politics of recognition must be unhitched from its association with psychological notions of identity and harm, and understood instead in a more materialist manner as a form of institutional and ideological status discrimination. As she puts it, her starting point is not subjective experience, but decentered discourses of social criticism. There is much to be said for Fraser's non-identitarian rendering of recognition, not least that it provides more objective criteria for adjudicating between different claims to recognition than the vague emotivist reference point of suffering that is often deployed by thinkers of recognition. However, the difficulty is that her rejection of the analytical relevance of the concept of identity for an understanding of recognition constrains the scope of her approach to social and political conflicts and leaves some important issues relating to agency and change unaddressed. Without any kind of hermeneutic perspective on the individual's experience of misrecognition, Fraser is unable to consider, for example, how many types of institutional and ideological discrimination are necessarily rooted in extra-institutional modes of being. In other words, identity injustices are conceived in a rather one-dimensional manner as externally imposed harms rather than also as lived injuries. It is as if Fraser accepts on face value that the concept of identity is irremediably subjectivist and therefore cannot be reconfigured in a relational, or what Pierre Bourdieu would call a praxeological manner, that connects the analysis of lived experience to a theory of power. In other words, you can focus on suffering without fetishizing it. Indeed, there is a sense in which, despite her objectivist re-rendering of the idea of recognition, Fraser herself does not in fact succeed in detaching it from some kind of tacit reference to what she would regard as subjectivist formulations of identity. The idea of subjective harm is in some ways displaced as the unthought preconditions of her idea of status subordination. For example, Fraser defines status injury as specific institutional discriminations, but also as sedimented ideological codes. It is difficult, however, to examine the entrenched operations of ideology without some kind of perspective on the formation of subjectivity, on some kind of idea of interpolation, and some interpretive take on how ideological codes are anchored in daily life. As a result of this objectivism, she takes institutional and ideological discriminations as already given without exploring their origins in and connection to a substrate of experiences and beliefs that sustain misrecognition. She focuses on the symptoms of injustice and treats misrecognition as an unfortunate fact rather than engaging with a deeper question of the sources of misrecognition. Deprived of such a perspective on the submerged experiences of everyday life, she also cannot adequately address pre-political and hidden forms of social suffering, and this leads to a narrow focus in her work on already established movements for recognition. The starting point of Fraser's theory is established movements that have already achieved a certain level of political mobilisation within the bourgeois public sphere. Types of social suffering that have not already crossed a certain perceptual threshold of public attention are disregarded. This filtering effect, where a relatively few types of conflict are deemed representative struggles, leaves unaddressed marginal forms of social suffering that do not conform to a paradigm of post-socialist conflict. Perhaps one of the most significant consequences of Fraser's underestimation of the analytical importance of the concept of self-identity is that she is unable to address certain aspects of social and political agency. A host of issues connected to the way in which suffering does or does not transmute into action, issues such as political mobilisation and the formation of oppositional consciousness, are taken as the always already achieved background to established movements of recognition and redistribution. It is this lack of attention to a notion of agency that underpins Fraser's arguably overstated critique of the free-floating idea of recognition as reifying identity. She only considers the idea of the struggle for recognition as an abstract paradigm, rather than from the practical perspective of political mobilisation. From such an action-theoretic perspective, many recognition struggles do not involve the simple assertion of collective identities, but rather are about self-organisation and the struggle by certain groups to be recognised as political actors in their own right. By understanding recognition struggles as a form of mobilisation to achieve political voice, the problem of reification is rendered less significant. A group's insistence on their difference may be seen as a contingent strategy for mobilisation, rather than just as simply any kind of fundamental claim about the group's distinctive qualities or identity. By failing to consider the idea of recognition in relation to political and social agency, Fraser's own critique inadvertently compounds, rather than deconstructs, the problem of the reification of identity. In short, the critique of subjectivism often comes too close to an abandonment of the concept of identity and a rejection of its analytical relevance for understanding certain aspects of oppression and agency. Fraser's objectivist orientation is unable to explain how an individual's understanding of their own identity and place in the world can motivate or disincline them to take action. The debate over recognition and redistribution is, after all, partly about the types of constraints that operate upon social actors and how it may be possible to overcome these constraints. It is important, therefore, to move beyond objectivism because agency cannot be deduced from abstract social structures or impersonal logics. Even if it were possible, for example, to typify actions as pertaining to either distributive or recognition claims, this abstract typology would still tell us little about why individuals will only act in some circumstances rather than others, and also why, faced with similar circumstances, only some of the individuals affected will choose to do anything about it. It follows, therefore, that a cluster of terms associated with self-identity cannot be written off as irrevocably subjectivist, because the perceptions and evaluations that individuals have of themselves and the social world, their intentions and aims, are important to an understanding of certain dimensions of political action. My recent work has focused on developing an account of some of these practical and intentional aspects of subjectivity and agency, whilst trying to avoid falling into an uncritical phenomenology of social experience on the one side and the abstractions of an objectivist account of social formation on the other. I've tried to sketch out aspects of what I call a relational phenomenology, whose aim is to connect an interpretive approach to embodied experience to an account of larger material and symbolic inequalities of power. In order to develop this relational phenomenology, I draw on Pierre Bourdieu's idea of habitus that yields a notion of embodied subjectivity which is in many respects similar to the dialogical conception proposed by thinkers of recognition, but is located more securely within a sociological account of power relations. The crucial difference is that for Bourdieu, like post-structuralist thinkers, power is coextensive with the process of subject formation, whereas in what I term the ontology of recognition, power is always in some sense or other secondary to this process. The positing of an intrinsic rather than extrinsic connection between subjectivity and power delivers a firmer grounding for understanding aspects of embodied agency in the context of the construction of social inequalities like gender. Many post-structuralists also start from similar insights on the intrinsic connection between power and subjectivity, Foucault most obviously. But where Bourdieu differs from them is that agency is not conceived primarily as a discursive effect, but also as a form of practical and intentional engagement with the world. As he puts it, the subjective representations of individuals must be taken into consideration if, in his words, one wants to account for the daily struggles which transform or preserve social structures. Unlike other standpoint perspectives, however, this phenomenological orientation does not attribute authenticity or epistemological privilege to an individual's self-interpretation. Rather, it is connected to latent power relations to show how, in many respects, the personal is the impersonal. Thus, to return to the issue of suffering for a moment, it is seen from a Bourdieusian perspective as neither incontestable evidence of oppression, as recognition theorists would have it, but nor is it seen as an ideological manipulation of sentiment. Rather, suffering is regarded as the expression of a situated consciousness which is profoundly shaped by a set of symbolic and material power relations specific to a given social location. I don't intend to go into a detailed discussion of Bourdieu's work here, but I suppose I should point out that my work is a selective interpretation of the relevance of some of his thoughts on embodied existence for an account of gender identity. It is most emphatically not intended as a wholesale resuscitation of his thought because it has many undeniably problematic aspects, not least of which is his simplistic account in masculine domination of how gender division operates. Nonetheless, there are important pointers towards a materialist account of embodied subjectivity that can be gleaned from the phenomenological aspects of his thought that, although present throughout his entire oeuvre, become increasingly prominent in his final work, most notably Pascalian Meditations. One of the issues that I try to develop in my recent work is to use the concept of habitus as a way of thinking about how sexuality is reproduced through class identity. It is important to think about the intertwinement of gender and class as an embodied disposition because it undoes a widespread tendency in feminist theory to think of agency in exclusively sexual terms, i.e. to construe women as sexual subjects rather than social subjects. Another of these insights, which I'm going to talk about in more general terms now, is that his work on embodied agency offers a possible corrective to the tendency in post-Foucauldian feminist theory to conceptualise agency in terms of abstract notions of indeterminacy. As I've already said, the objectivist turn that Fraser makes in the recognition redistribution debate is not confined to her work, but is a widespread tendency in cultural and feminist theory on identity. This objectivism, I think, is related to what I've called the negative paradigm of subject formation that is inherited from post-structural thought and which tends to construe subjectivity in the essentially passive terms as an effect of discourse. This discursive objectivism rejects the relevance of concepts of self-identity for an account of agency and therefore tends to construe radical political agency in terms of the inherent indeterminacy, usually of systems of meaning. I'm referring obviously in part here to post-Foucauldian work on identity such as Judith Butler's influential work on performative resignification, where counter-hegemonic agency is construed as some kind of tarrying with the indeterminate. This emphasis on indeterminacy flows from the well-known exclusionary logic that post-structural thinkers regard as a central dynamic to subject formation. Unified subjects are constituted primarily through the disavowal and derogation of troubling otherness and alterities. Indeed, the very intensity of the disavowal is a symptom of the extent to which that difference is constitutive of the subject in denial. It follows, therefore, from this logic that a radical politics based on the acceptance of difference and otherness must necessarily challenge the stable and fixed features of subjectivity. Thus, Butler describes her radical politics of resignification as a disruption to the capacity to sustain one's enduring status as a subject, as, in her words, risking the incoherence of identity. It is not just post-Foucauldian theory that posits radical agency as indeterminacy. The recent renewed feminist interest in the thought of Hannah Arendt has thrown up an emerging new line of argument, which states that the preoccupation of contemporary feminist theory with the subject question limits ways of thinking about freedom and action. According to Linda Zirilli in Feminism and the Abyss of Freedom, the concern with issues of subjectivity and agency has hampered feminists' ability to think of freedom beyond the assertion of identity. It remains stuck in the assertion of the I can, rather than considering the possibilities of the I will. As a result of this preoccupation with what Zirilli calls the vicious circle of subjectivity and agency, it's hard to see how politics could ever be a truly transformative practice that might create something new, forms of life that would be more freedom-enabling. Zirilli finds much potential in Hannah Arendt's future-oriented and radically contingent notion of action to rethink freedom outside the parameters of subjectivity and agency. And Zirilli's reading Arendt's idea of action is echoed by other thinkers also using Arendt, such as Kelly Oliver, Mary Dietz, and Patrick Markell, who also claim that by focusing on the unfinished and indeterminate aspects of the future-oriented dimensions of action, it becomes possible to challenge the certainties of the sovereign subject. I have no quarrel with these various formulations of political agency as indeterminacy, insofar as they express a valuable ideal or utopian goal, that it is important to challenge the settled and doxic ways in which we think about ourselves and others. My quarrel is with the abstract way in which these ideas of indeterminacy are conceived, that disregard certain phenomenal aspects of embodied existence, and in doing so, empty themselves of much meaningful content in terms of an idea of political agency. It may be the case that the future-oriented dimensions of action render subjectivity more fragile and uncertain than is often acknowledged in some theories of recognition. It is one thing, however, to assert an essential temporal indeterminacy as an abstract condition of possibility of action and interaction, but it is another to trace out what this might mean at the level of lived social relations, which even at their most informal and indeterminate, therefore, are ineluctably embedded in entrenched hierarchies of power. In other words, from a lived perspective, many aspects of embodied identity are experienced as determinate. As David Cousins Hoy says in his recent book, Critical Resistance, one difficulty that arises with the Nietzschean emphasis on the historical malleability of subjectivity and embodiment is that pluralism seems to turn into sheer unconstrained proliferation. The task then becomes to explain why 1,000 possibilities are not simply actualised, and why instead societies manage to be fairly stable. Social action and interaction are certainly indeterminate to some degree, and this is what gives social life its open-ended quality. However, action and interaction are also determinate in that they are relatively predictable and conformist and routinely contribute to the reproduction of systemic inequalities of race, class and gender. If the idea of agency as indeterminacy is that to have substantive content, therefore, in terms of helping us to think about how we move from the actual to the possible, it must be thought through more carefully in relation to these social complexities. In other words, agency must be thought in terms other than a sort of misleading antithesis of determinacy and indeterminacy. The formulation of political agency in terms of abstract notions of linguistic or temporal indeterminacy does not go very far in unpacking the determinate nature of many dimensions of social existence. Some of these dimensions pertain in part to the insidious operations of power upon embodied subjects, but they also pertain to the deep investments that subjects themselves make in ideas of coherence and stability and order in making sense of themselves and their lives. From this perspective, it would appear to be theoretically precipitate for feminists to abandon their concern with subjectivity and power, as Zirilli and others would have us do. Rather, it is important to develop more socio-centric accounts of embodied identity and agency for two reasons. First, because it helps us to think through the specific ways in which hierarchical social differences are constructed and the concrete strategies that need to be adopted to overcome them. And second, because it's important for thought about agency to move away from the assumption that indeterminacy is necessarily radical. And therefore, in moving away from this assumption, to move away from a second assumption of construing agency in terms of domination and resistance. And I want to conclude this lecture by talking about these two issues briefly. First, the importance of developing a more sociocentric understanding of embodied identity in order to understand aspects of political agency in a more strategic, substantive way than appeals to abstract notions of indeterminacy. I want to illustrate what I mean with reference to a recent interesting exchange between Wendy Brown and Annabelle Lever on rights discourse as a means for challenging gender oppression. In her article, Suffering the Paradoxes of Rights, Brown elaborates on some of the inconsistencies and contradictions of the language of rights for articulating and addressing women's inequality in Western democracies. Many of these contradictions are familiar and stem from the basic discrepancy originally pointed out by Marx between formal and substantive rights. For Brown, as for many feminists, the central paradox of rights is that the more they are formulated in an abstract or gender-neutral way, the more likely they are to enhance the privilege of men and eclipse the needs of women as subordinates. The necessarily abstract nature of universal rights renders women's subordination such a thin concept that the particulars of women's inequality vanish from the content and justification of the right. The difficulty is, however, that the effort to redress this empty impartiality leads to a second paradox. That is, the articulation of more gender-specific rights risks encoding a definition of women premised upon their subordinate status. Not only will such a definition inevitably be partial, i.e. it will be based on the needs of experiences of only some women, but also it risks binding women into a status as subordinates with a possible effect, as we have seen, of engendering a fetishistic attachment to victim identity and the politics of suffering. These paradoxes are compounded by the further paradox, again proceeding from a central observation made by Marx, namely that the individualistic form that rights takes inevitably limits their efficacy vis-a-vis overturning systemic equalities, such as gender subordination. Despite the fact that these paradoxes appear endlessly self-cancelling, Brown does not entirely abandon rights-based approaches. Rather, she finishes with an injunction to consider how the indeterminate nature of paradox might, quote, gain political richness when it is understood as affirming the impossibility of justice in the present and as articulating the contours of justice in the future. In response to Brown, Lever argues that it's only from a certain abstract perspective, or epistemological perspective, I suppose, that paradox appears to be the central feature of rights. There are undeniable tensions and shortcomings in using rights discourse as a means to secure the overcoming of systemic oppressions. Nonetheless, in Lever's view, many of the so-called paradoxes highlighted by Brown are not necessary or inevitable to the structure of rights, but can in fact be overcome through political judgment and strategy. For example, Lever claims that the way in which rights currently work against women's interests is a concrete indication of the ways in which both the form and substance of existing rights might be transformed. However, for such transformative strategies to be effective, it does not help particularly to see rights as inherently paradoxical. Rather, it should force us to think more carefully about what is necessary to see and treat men and women as equals within and beyond a discourse of rights. It pays to regard rights, in Lever's words, as the more or less predictable result of and guide to the forms of inequality in our society, both the ones of which we are already aware and those of which we still have to learn. Ultimately, for Lever, the problem with Brown's analysis of rights is that it is abstracted from any political or institutional context, and this abstraction means that she reifies paradox as a central feature of rights. In other words, there may indeed be features of rights that are paradoxical, but these are not necessarily the most important or the most relevant features that oppressed groups should focus on in their struggles to attain equality. One way of approaching how rights-based approaches might be rendered more effective in overcoming gender inequality is to consider the reasons why women and other subordinate groups are disinclined to seek legal remedies in the first place. Rather than considering rights as paradoxes, it might be more fruitful, for example, to think of how individuals relate, or more pertinently, do not relate to rights-based political discourse. In her study of attitudes towards a legal regulation of offensive public speech, Laura Beth Nielsen found that there were significant differences between how groups thought about the way in which such offensive speech should be dealt with by the law, and these differences correlated to differences of race, class, and gender. Although there was a widespread agreement across all the groups that she surveyed against the legal regulation of speech, the only group that articulated this opposition through rights-based reasoning along First Amendment lines were the white male respondents to her survey. Perhaps surprisingly, the groups of individuals who were much more likely to be the targets of offensive speech on a daily basis, women and black men, were not only opposed to the legal regulation of such speech, but did not even construe it in the first place as a problem that pertained to the law and legal remedy at all. In the case of women, Nielsen explains this reluctance to see public verbal harassment as a problem into which the law can helpfully intervene. She explains this with reference to the convergent effects of overarching norms about appropriate feminine behaviour. On the one hand, women are expected to be good girls and avoid public harassment by dressing and behaving correctly. On the other hand, a gendered expectation emerging from the individualising tendencies of late modernity is that women are expected to be autonomous in the sense that when confronted with harassment, they should be able to stick up for themselves without making a fuss or construing themselves as victims. These gender norms are, of course, not experienced as external expectations or impositions, but are internalised in the form of practical dispositions and commonsensical views. And it results in the form of what Bourdieu would call misrecognition, or the partial complicity of the oppressed with her own oppression. The female respondents of Nielsen's study disconnected the problem of harassment from the broader social apparatus of gender subordination and fell back on the doxic interpretation of verbal harassment as an isolated incident unconnected to the social institution of sexism. Nielsen draws various conclusions from her research about the contingent and iterative nature of legal consciousness, which varies according to social position and life course. From my perspective, the interesting implication of this work on legal consciousness is how identity and self-understanding affect agency, in this case the individual's willingness to even consider certain types of action over others, or indeed to prefer inaction to any kind of action at all. From this perspective, it is not the paradoxical nature of rights that is the main problem confronting feminist activists, but a host of more basic problems pertaining to political mobilisation, such as levels of oppositional consciousness and dispositional disinclination amongst many women to construe problems related to gender inequality as legally or politically redressable. It draws attention to one of the main insights of Habitus, that social constraints such as gender and class are lived as profound psychological dispositions or structures of feeling. Unless feminists and other theorists engage with these profound disinclinations and dispositions more fully, then formulations of radical agency as an embrace of the indeterminate will continue to seem like an abstract promise that things could be otherwise, but which is removed from the embodied reality of those it's meant to help. This perhaps will be more clear if I move to my final point, which is about the problematic assumption that often underlies conceptions of agency as indeterminacy, namely that indeterminacy is inherently radical. This assumption surfaces in many different ways in contemporary thought on identity. One of them is in certain formulations of political agency as resistance. Although ideas of resistance have moved away from the kind of the exhaustive criticism they received about their uncritical populism, they have been reformulated, I think, or they've resurfaced in a different way in recent theory on identity in terms of ideas of unruly emotion, disruptive desires, and other indeterminate features of embodied social existence. These moments of non-identity are thereby implicitly invested with an inherent contestatory status. I realise I haven't given you any examples of that, but I could just refer you to some of you who were in the group earlier, the recent stuff of Beverly Skeggs's or some of the work of Elspeth Probyn as an example of, I think, this idea of resistance as indeterminacy. This is not to deny that certain ineffable and indeterminate aspects of existence are harbingers of change. It is certainly the case that everyday life is frequently marked by emotional and corporeal experiences whose meaning is opaque, but which are profoundly felt and disrupt the closure of routinized existence. But to attribute to these inchoate and ineffable emotions and desires an apodictic resistant status is to implicitly invoke an uncritical phenomenology which fails to connect emotions and bodily affects to underlying power structures. As Bourdieu puts it, one may doubt the reality of a resistance which ignores the resistance of reality. In this vein, Rosemary Hennessy has argued, for example, that the cultural feminist preoccupation with a certain notion of indeterminate or ambivalent desire rests on an unexamined perspective of middle-class privilege. The construal of political agency as indeterminate desire is, in her view, a rarefication that abstracts embodied sexual identity from the historical and social relations that produce and sustain it. She says that the celebration of the lesbian as a figure of unfettered lust fails to examine the social conditions which allow it to arise at the same time as, quote, welfare reform debates in which the sexuality and needs of unmarried poor women and their children have become the punitive targets of state-mandated personal responsibility. Furthermore, what remains open to question is the extent to which notions of oppositional agency as construed as indeterminacy are in fact congruent with an increasing commodification of the life world. Again, to quote Hennessy, these more open, fluid, ambivalent sexual identities are quite compatible with the mobility, adaptability, and ambivalence required of service workers today and with the new, more fluid forms of the commodity. In sum, I must say, I think Hennessy's great, but I think her work is slightly overstated. In sum, certain radical thinkers need to scrutinise more carefully the too ready assumption that indeterminacy is in itself necessarily radical or challenging. They need also, therefore, to move away from formulations of political agency in terms of couplets of domination and resistance. Insofar as any action is never one of simple mechanical reproduction, nonconformity and indeterminacy is a widespread characteristic of social action, but this cannot be taken as an automatic guarantor of any social challenge. In the light of the diversified nature of an intensified consumerism and of changes in methods of social control, what appears to be a nonconformist or resistant act at one level might at another level be its opposite. It is these complex imbrications of freedoms with constraints that Nicholas Rose has in mind, for example, when he argues that in an era where the regulation of identity is a central mode of social control, it is necessary to break away from the simplifying couplet domination resistance. Generalising Foucault's idea of governmentality as a conduct of conduct, Rose argues that individuals are controlled not through explicit forms of domination, but through rationalised techniques and devices which orient action to certain usefully social ends, certain useful social ends. The shaping of identity is a key strategy in these techniques of government, and therefore it is important to rethink identity beyond the formula that regimes of power necessarily falsify or distort human subjectivity. Rather, these styles of government produce new modes of subjectification, new ways of being and acting that make up subjects as free persons in a manner that is neither authentic or inauthentic. On this view, freedom is not the obverse of domination or control, rather it is a capacity for liberty that is drawn out of individuals through the government of social practices. It is a similar idea of freedom in constraint that is expressed in Bourdieu's idea of regulated liberties, which are manifest in embodied practice. Bourdieu objects to ideas of resistance because they are based in absolutized notions of indeterminacy, which fail to take account of the deep-rooted hold that bodies, that power has over bodies. Even the most subversive symbolic actions, if they are not to condemn themselves to failure, must reckon with dispositions and with the limitations these impose on innovative imagination and action. Against unqualified ideas of indeterminacy, Bourdieu understands change as generated by the interplay of necessity and contingency. Habitus is in a state of permanent revision, but this revision is rarely radical because the new and the unexpected is always incorporated upon the basis of the previously established embodied dispositions. He does not deny the importance of acts of iconoclasm and subversion, which challenge social boundaries by enacting the previously unthinkable. However, for these acts of subversion to have lasting force, they must have some impact on social structures, revealing them to be in a state of uncertainty and crisis, or awakening a critical consciousness of their arbitrariness and fragility. This does not amount to a denial of the creative agency of oppressed groups and individuals, because there is always a margin of freedom in the workings of symbolic power, which is created in the same instant as individuals are aligned to the status quo. But it is, however, to recognise the importance of putting the creative dimensions of action in the context of immediate and latent relations of power that operate in any situation. The idea of regulated liberties yields a more gradual and uneven concept of change than the idea of resistance as indeterminacy. Sources of change are varied and changes manifest themselves in a discontinuous and non-synchronous ways, insofar as they are mediated through different fields of action and different social structures. Change occurs within gender relations, for example, in Borgesian terms, where it may occur, because of the interplay between cultural norms and embodied dispositions. Arguably, a generational dislocation, something that he calls a hysteresis effect, a generational dislocation between norms and dispositions has arisen in the last few decades, where cultural values have historically outstripped the expectations that individuals have largely inherited from their parents. So to kind of put that simply, we're all going around with kind of emotional habituses that are more suited to the 1950s than the new millennium. Such a dislocation may be generative of both new freedoms and new insecurities in contemporary gender relations. The expectations of long-term monogamous intimacy structured around a conventional sexual division of labour are increasingly undermined by emergent tendencies in Western democracies, such as the rise of divorce, the increased entry of women into higher education and work, and the decline of the birth rate. The emancipating effects of such shifts upon men and women is unclear, however, because they are neither wholly positive or negative, neither straightforwardly liberating or constraining, resistant or conformist. Habitus illuminates only one incarnate dimension of such processes of gender restructuring, but insofar as it exteriorises embodied practice in relation to social structures, it gestures towards a more mediated and nuanced understanding of change than the idea of resistance as indeterminacy. And it also highlights the necessity of distinguishing more clearly between two senses of agency that are often conflated in the idea of resistance. Agency denotes both the sense in which individuals are not just passive bearers of social roles, and a more politicised sense in which individuals are understood to actively challenge their conditions of existence. And these two are often run together, and perhaps they shouldn't be, given that, under conditions of global capital, so many areas of individual activity are subject to commodifying forces, and many practices that may be hailed as resistant have in fact little political bite, or have their political bite removed from them through being commodified. This is neither to fall back into unmitigated cynicism, nor to resuscitate romantic ideas of revolutionary change. It is rather to emphasise that in thinking about agency, it's important to go beyond dualisms of domination and resistance, determinacy and indeterminacy, subjectivism and objectivism, in order to situate subjects more securely within a social theoretical account of power relations. Finished.